Welcome to Truth News Radio Australia. I'm Joshua Jackson. It is the 1st of August 2008. A jam-packed show today, one of a very, very important broadcast. We're talking to the extraordinary filmmaker Glenn Clancy, the maker of the Bali bombing expose film, the truth behind the Bali bombings, and his film is called
Fool Me Twice.
Fool Me Twice. We've also got Simon Harris here, an expert in music and history of music. We're also going to talk about Dennis Kucinich's impeachment notices to Bush. And
in fact, we're going to give you that right now.
Truth News Radio Australia.
May I proceed, Mr. Chairman? I want to thank the chair for this opportunity to testify.
Dennis Kucinich.
And I want to recognize my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, Ranking Member Smith, and my colleagues from the House who I work with, who are my friends, who I respect their integrity and their honor. And I think it's important that we proceed among ourselves in that way, and so that we can be of service to our nation in the highest manner. Our country has been at war in Iraq and has occupied the streets and villages of Iraq for 5 years, 4 months, and 6 days. The war has caused the deaths of 4,127 American soldiers and the deaths of as many as 1 million innocent Iraqis. The war will cost the American people upwards of $3 trillion and is the main contributing factor to the destruction of our domestic economy. Mr. Chairman, I would ask unanimous consent to enter SJ Res 45 and HJ Res 114 into the record.
Without objection, so ordered.
The primary justifications for going to war outlined in legislation which the White House sent to Congress in October of 2002 have been determined conclusively to be untrue. Iraq was not continuing to threaten the national security interests of the United States. Iraq was not continuing to possess and develop a significant chemical and biological weapons capability. Iraq was not actively seeking a nuclear weapons capability. Iraq did not have the willingness to attack the United States. Iraq had not demonstrated capability and willingness to use weapons of mass destruction. Iraq could not launch a surprise attack against the United States or its armed forces. Therefore, there was not an extreme magnitude of harm that would result in the United States, that would result to the United States and its citizens from such an attack. The aforementioned did not justify the use of force by the United States to defend itself. Iraq had no connection with the attacks of 9/11 or with al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. Iraq possessed no weapons of mass destruction to transfer to anyone. Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction and therefore had no capability of launching a surprise attack against the United States or its armed forces, and no capability to provide them to international terrorists who would do so. However, many members of Congress relied on these representations from the White House to inform their decision to support the legislation that authorized the use of force against Iraq. We all know present and former colleagues who have said that if they knew then what they know now, they would not have voted to permit an attack upon Iraq. The war was totally unnecessary, unprovoked, and unjustified. The question for Congress is this: what responsibility does the President and members of his administration have for that unnecessary, unprovoked, and unjustified war? The rules of the House prevent me or any witness from utilizing familiar terms. But we could put two and two together in our minds. We can draw inferences about culpability. Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent to enter H.Res. 333, H.Res. 1258, and H.Res. 1345 into the record.
Without objection, so ordered.
I request that each member read the three bills that I have authored, bills which are now awaiting consideration by the Judiciary Committee. I am confident that the reader will reach the same conclusions that I have about culpability. What, then, should we do about it? The decision before us is whether to honor our oath as members of Congress to support and defend the Constitution that has been trampled time and again over the last 7 years. The decision before us is whether to stand up for the checks and balances designed by our founding fathers to prevent excessive power grabs by either the judicial, legislative, or executive branch of government. The decision before us is whether to restore faith in government, in justice, and in the rule of law. The decision before us is whether Congress will endorse with its silence the methods used to take us into the Iraq War. The decision before us is whether to demand accountability for one of the gravest justices imaginable. The decision before us is whether Congress will stand up to tell future presidents that America has seen the last of these injustices, not the first. I believe the choice is clear. I ask this committee to think and then to act now in order to enable this Congress to right a very great wrong and to hold accountable those who misled this nation. I thank you.
There we have it. An incredible and stirring speech. What did you think, Josh? Is that the first time you've heard that?
That's the first time I've heard Dennis Kucinich's version. I did watch another chap as part of the hearings, and he was absolutely amazing. We might have to play that later.
You may have heard Vincent.
That's the one.
Vincent, forgotten the surname, but he's a well-known attorney, very well-known. He's written various books about Charles Manson. And
he was the prosecutor against Charles
Manson.
That's
right, yes. That was a very stirring speech as well.
Yeah.
I still think that Kucinich is the man of the moment.
This guy's risking his own life, folks.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's responsible for this. He's done this. He's made this happen.
Mm. That's right. And hopefully, you know, the American people will push their local representatives to follow ahead with the impeachment process, because this was just an initial hearing.
Yeah, this is a special committee. In fact, they're not even allowed to call it an impeachment hearing.
It's amazing.
They're allowed to call it a special committee.
They're not allowed to say George Bush is guilty of anything. They're not allowed to say that he might be guilty. They're not allowed to say the word impeach. They're not allowed to do all these things, and the audience isn't allowed to react, positive or negatively.
Members of the audience were, I think, forcibly removed because they were clapping.
Yeah, you're not allowed to clap to show that you're for or against anything. It was one of the most whitewashed on the hearing side.
Incredible,
to the to the witnesses that were giving their
and how much coverage of this did we get in Australia, Josh?
Well, nothing. We got nothing. Not one bit. Meanwhile, we get a massive story about Barack Obama scratching his ass on the news. You know, honestly, and this is a really big story. It's absolutely huge. Again, the mainstream media slicing in their own wrists and finishing their own game off, because media outlets like ourselves are the ones of the future, because we are the only ones on the internet. The internet is the only media source now actually giving the proper information that people want to hear.
We are, and it's a pretty heavy burden we bear, and we don't bear it lightly.
No.
Now, I just want to welcome onto the show Simon. Simon, grab your mic and please be very welcome here for the next hour or so with us. And you're going to be telling us a little bit about music. And you also are quite aware of a lot of things that are going on in the world as I've recently learned.
Yeah, that's right. I think quite a few people are aware of Karadzic being taken over to The Hague to be indicted for the term that he's broadly known for, and that is ethnic cleansing. A bit of an understatement. That's basically 8,000, mostly boys and men, of Muslim descent slaughtered in a place called Srebrenica. So he's in there awaiting his fate. It'd be interesting to see whether he commits suicide like Slobodan Milosevic did. I'm sure he knows he's a dead man. What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure about this region and this of what is going on in there, but it's good to see someone of such disgusting history,
Radovan Karadzic, yes,
actually being put to trial. Now, whether it's going to be a fair trial or not, who knows? But
look, you know, he's a psychiatrist.
Well, yeah, and he's also recently taking up alternative therapy, apparently.
But he also was submitting regularly on a weekly basis some poetry to an alternative publishing house. And yes, he was a sports psychiatrist, I think, to Red Belgrade, thus proving the point that anyone can be an absolute sort of despot figure and then simply vaporize into any form they want.
Well, look, I hate to continually beat the same drum, but I am well aware of the fact that the Yugoslavian war and the Serbian dictatorship that was behind that war were manipulated again from our good old friends from the other side of the Atlantic. And I'm not just making this up. I had a very close friend who's from Bosnia who told me a lot about what happened in the lead up to that war. And it was orchestrated. I mean, the first war that occurred between Croatia and Serbia was orchestrated. The ongoing program of ethnic cleansing was orchestrated because it was intentional on the part of those who wanted to create the conditions for what we now see as the EU in its new form. The important point to remember here is that Yugoslavia before the late 1980s was an absolute poster boy nation for how communism could work. It was a brilliant country. It was successful. It was free. It had a good economy, but it wasn't overly commercialized. Yugoslavia was an incredible country, which had to be destroyed as part of the current program. And this time it wasn't the Republicans in the United States. It was the Clinton administration through that whole period. There was a very deliberate destabilization that occurred, and the friend that I had who grew up in Bosnia and became a refugee here, she was well aware of the fact that they decided they were going to have this war, folks. It wasn't as you've been told. Slobodan Milosevic, the Radovan Karadzic, these people, they wanted to have a war. They felt like doing it, and they damn well did it. Now, that might sound ridiculous. Doesn't make a lot of sense because, yes, they were being manipulated from behind the scenes as well. But they all wanted to. The Croats wanted to as well. And the Albanians, who were behind a lot of the problems with creating the tensions between Muslims and Serbians, had been provoked into this as well, because there was a long history of Albanians in insurgency coming into Serbia and basically messing around with people. Anyway, it's a big subject. But, yeah.
Well, the other thing that obviously Tito was very instrumental in what's known as the non-aligned communist aspect of the former Federation of Yugoslavia, and had a very ingenious, not a technique, but policy of power sharing amongst the seven, I think it's seven federations, I might be wrong there, to prevent any one federation, in other words, either Croatia or Slovenia or Bosnia-Herzegovina, from gaining prominence, to stop what he called his Lenin after his Stalin. And this is a communist who was in a position where he was having to put up with the distrust of Churchill, because obviously he was communist, although he was non-aligned, which meant he had distrust of centralized communism from Moscow, and at the same time having to fight the Chetniks, who allowed SS divisions down through Croatia, who incidentally was recognized initially as the first state to be part of Europe by Germany. Many people weren't all that aware of the history then, and of course that was incredibly offensive to the Serbs, who'd fought against the SS divisions in Croatia. And that was the spark, really, that started the breakdown of this power sharing. And really, how else could you split the federation up but by doing just that?
And what we know is that Slobodan Milosevic was supported by the West. He was supported by the Americans, just like Saddam Hussein was supported by the Americans, just like, General Pinochet was supported by the Americans, just like the guy in Panama was supported by the Americans, until they don't like them anymore. And then they say, oh, this guy's a terrible, evil tyrant. We'll have to get rid of him. It's the same thing. I mean, they did with Slobodan what they did with Saddam Hussein.
Well, they set
they
up
supported him all
guys.
The way along, knowing that he was a tyrant. And then they said, oh, look, we've got this terrible person we have to get rid of. And everyone goes along with it, going, oh, yeah, he's a bad person. Oh, we have to go along with the bombing of another country. And that was under Clinton, folks. So, you know, this is nothing to do with whether it's left or right. This has nothing to do with conservative, liberal. This is a policy.
It's the war machine.
Hegemony and geopolitical control.
It's a constant war machine of parading through, using the left and right against each other as a device to then push more war. And setting up these fall guys that will in the future. I mean, it's almost like...
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's almost...
so tragic.
You know, futuristic think. You know, thinking into the future, thinking ahead. Let's set up some guy that we can invade later on almost, you know, that we can sell arms to. He'll do something horrific. Then we can come in as the saviours and bomb the crap out of him.
What was interesting was that Serbia itself had two autonomous provinces. One was called Vojvodina, the other one's Kosovo, and they both had their own separate sort of government. So they, as the name says, they were autonomous. So the first thing they tried to do was get rid of those two areas. And obviously Vojvodina is mainly on an ethnic level. I hate talking like this because it means generalizing, not particularly Muslim. So you can imagine that these men would be drafted into the army and basically put into the front line against an ethnic group that they don't really have much to do with. It was actually in the south, there in the north. It was an absolute ideal opportunity to revert back to really a kind of ethnic sort of war. And, of course, what happens afterwards is ethnic cleansing. Karadzic, incidentally, did return to his village when he was a child to find most of his family wiped out. Now, okay, that doesn't justify what he's done, but it certainly does, to me, indicate that no one really read the history books and no one really paid too much attention as to who might be offended and what that might motivate people to do. Doesn't excuse it, but it was complete ignorance by and arrogance by Europe and their rush to make the EC, I guess you could say, in the long run, yeah.
And it's that concept of blowback again, you know.
And what I see it as a prelude to the new Iron Fist, which is, you know, within a velvet glove, but the Iron Fist of the EU, which is coming. Now, it hasn't been fully ratified yet. The Lisbon Treaty was thrown back by the Irish, but there is an Iron Fist coming, and But by all indications of history, there'll be more ethnic cleansing to come. And it'll happen in ways that you can't quite, you know, predict now. But
and with the whole, what was the in Croatia and these sort of states, what was the major source of income and resource?
Well, the army actually in Slovenia, less so. They tended to go into because they're alpine, more alpine culture there. So there's resources and hydroelectric and sort of banking and so on and so forth. I mean, they would, through being part of the Federation, a lot of the wealth would go back into Belgrade. Belgrade was very, very historically sort of empowered by the army, and most young men would go into the army and rise to a high rank. You can imagine that if that particular area started to lose power, what on earth that would do in the minds of some of these families who go back many, many generations. And as I say, it doesn't justify what went on, but I do believe that Serbia was singled out as the bogey state, as it were. How on earth can you have that?
Mm. And it provides a mechanism to create a new kind of united. It, in a way, by creating a bogey state that everyone had to unite against, it creates this artificial supranational kind of cohesion within Europe, but it's artificially created. It's not based on real interests and you know, shared the positive things. It's based on the negative things.
Well, interesting you say that, because initially you mentioned about music. There is one music entity that existed prior to the breakup of Yugoslavia. It was a group called the Neue Slowenische Kunst, and one of the bands that were quite prominent there was a band called Laibach, which is basically the occupation name of Ljubljana. They're also quite a big influence on Rammstein, who I've never really heard, but I think they're a heavy sort of outfit. But their whole idea was the idea of let us create what's known as the United States of Europe, but as a form of provocation. I mean, the name was a provocation because they were originally punks.
Right.
And they were labelled as sort of fascists because punks weren't really sort of well known, and they had black clothes on. And right. So the media said, oh, well, you're obviously, you know, have an affinity for neo-Nazi sort of stuff. And they said, no, not at all, you know. And that wasn't printed. And then they did, you know, they demanded to have a right of reply. They were denied that. So they decided to become the Frankenstein that the media tarred them with. And they actually went for it in a big way. I mean, they actually used searchlights and they used various iconography from the Second World War and British imperialism and basically socialist realism as well. It became an embarrassment for Belgrade and were banned a few times, but started to get quite popular in America, of course.
Was this during the 1990s? Or
this was in about 1987. They did a cover version of One Vision by Queen in a very sort of Nuremberg style with
side drums.
So this
was in the 70s, was it?
No, this was about 1987. I actually went to see them a couple of times, and I've met them as well. And they claim there's certain things that they're doing in order to provoke. So, I mean, this is really what leads into their influence, which was punk. And then the whole idea is to, you know, provoke what's known as agitpop, agitation, propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. So you become
agitpop.
Well, agitation, propaganda.
Agitprop.
You know.
Yeah. Right. Agitprop.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You'd become this embarrassment in order to what's interesting is you actually become an entity of the thing that the media want you to be, but bigger. So you become the Frankenstein. Mm. That was their philosophy on that one. But anyway, that's touching on music there, which started off talking about Karadzic.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, the punk scene didn't really, to me, seem to have a lot to do with sort of social, you know, political. But there was a couple of bands that did, like The Clash.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned.
But there and then there was a lot of other stuff that was just seemed like more like just fashion, you know.
Yeah,
just like, you know, a safety pin in your nose and, you know, vomiting on people. I mean, but yeah, I mean, The Clash certainly had a political edge to them. Any other punk? I mean, what other of that era can you sort of cite?
As regards deliberately political or just
Well, at least had an agenda. I mean, I don't mean an agenda. I just mean a philosophical...
A fire in their belly about political state. About,
instead of just, you know, basically focusing on, you know, fashion, sex or drugs.
Trying to make some money from a fad.
Yeah, yeah. I mean...
Well, actually, their inspiration came from America and bands like the MC5 and Iggy Pop and the Stooges.
Sure.
The MC5 particularly were quite linked in with the Weathermen and the Black Panther movement, and they even formed the White Panthers.
Which that's interesting.
I'm sure the Black Panthers found quite laughable, you know, because they're not... Well, I guess you could argue that they're in the same economic situation, but then that takes you back to the blues and that whole sort of concept that you've got to be in pain in order to be expressive. Now, it's a very dodgy concept in itself. I know that Clapton wanted to, you know, become a heroin addict, actually, to try and almost lose everything, to get back to this sense of desperation in order to kindle the embers of his gluttonous L.A. lifestyle. But that could just be patronizing.
Well, yeah, and it's quite fascinating that you say that, because if you look at society at the moment and the people, I mean, I know the friends I have, the younger generations of our era they live this society where everything is around them, they've got everything at their fingertips, and they're not really worried about politics. They're not really worried about anything because they've got their iPhone and they've got their gadgets and they've got everything they need and the food on the table. So to sort of to get passionate and I don't, you know, I wish it wasn't like that, and it probably isn't, I'm sure.
But music in history, where, you know, if you go back to, you know, folk music traditions, generally that was about giving people some sort of solace in life, you know, like, because life has always been known to be hard, you know. And whether it's like slaves, you know, who invented jazz, or people, you know, like, you know, Woody Guthrie singing about oppression in coal mines, and you know what was done to workers, or whether, you know, whether it's just about the pain of love and you know, beauty. And you know, these primal things, though, that are really powerful, that make you feel really strong emotions. Mm. Whereas, like, I mean, this is just my impressions of what music has become more and more, is become background music, or music for a mood, music just to provide wallpaper for your life, in a sense.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Brian, you know, got those ambient albums out in mid-70s, music for airports.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, shopping mall music to consume to, fine, you know, that's all well and good. But I think on a physiological level, the basic beating of a heart means that in any kind of heightened situation, if you get any drumming going, for instance, always troops of drums are always associated with the voodoo, or with going into some sort of raging trance. Even you know, modern military, you know, in the last 50 years, they even went into battlefields with drums. So I think just on a biological level, there is, and prior to spoken word, then obviously music was prior to the formulation of language.
Mm. And I think what you're saying also explains this sort of popularity of trance dance music and just sort of very repetitive beats, which seem to really be able to put people into some kind of altered state that they like. But again, there seems to be something. I sense a loss of something when it's just become so electronic and so focused on just that. And then there's 100,000 different, versions of it, but it all sounds the same.
Fast food, it becomes this fast food music, really.
Yeah.
Trance, you mentioned that. I mean, there's another sort of way of looking at it. There's a great book called Black Vinyl, White Powder, which is by Simon Napier Bell, a manager that started off in the 50s in Soho, and he managed a lot of bands like Wham and the Yardbirds. And his claim is that every single era has its drug, and out of that drug, music comes. So, you've got your Hash sort of period with Hendrix and the Stones.
Interesting, okay. Yeah.
And then you had the more speed-based stuff with the Who and the Mods, and then the ease and the rave scene, etc. But whether or not you can actually gain that sense of heightened experience through purely rhythm and maybe just hardly any lighting in a cave somewhere, and then you go out and bash someone's head in, I don't know. I think that there is a primordial basis to all this that we've been removed from, and that has shifted somewhere else. That's what I think that's happened.
I have a vast conspiracy theory to propose to you that this this music, which I have seen groups of people down. Sometimes I go walking down at the Botanical Gardens past Mrs. Macquarie's Point, and I've seen a dance parties set up there, which are I guess paid events, and they'll have 500 or so people all packed into a very small area, all fenced off, so they can't even get out. It's like a cattle enclosure, really, and literally the people in there are like cattle, and they've got all these giant loudspeakers above them all the way around, beating out this ferocious dance beat that just crushes you, turns you to jelly, right? And I've walked past and I thought, this is some kind of experiment. Like this is not people having entertainment. This is something that's being done to people. you're laughing with me or at me?
Just at the concept.
But I mean, it really strikes you when you see it, and you think, this is just not. This doesn't even look happy. They don't even look even. There's no freedom in this, and they're all penned in.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, what's it all about?
It's funny because we used to go to these folk festivals, and I think it's a form, it all comes down to economics again.
Yeah.
I always banter on about economics of everything, but I used to go to these folk festivals where it was literally an oval, like a cricket oval or something like that. And the oval was just the one little wire that was about a meter off the ground that would go around the circumference of the oval, and that was the perimeter, and you sort of had your tents on the outside, and all the music stages, about six different stages were in, and people would get up there and play, and it was very, very relaxed.
That sounds
and
nice.
As it got more popular, every year it got more and more popular, and eventually they put up a little fence around, and then what, and then the next year we came along and there was all these signs saying, no dogs, always dogs, and the fences got a little higher, and then the next year there was barbed wire. And everyone had to have passes, and all of a sudden security guards were everywhere.
And then
it would get more and more, and eventually it got so big and full of security, and it was just awful to go to.
Mm.
And eventually the event stopped because it was too expensive to run. So I mean, music becomes this. Its own economic downfall from being too much of a business instead of pure entertainment of people just gathering together and wanting to have fun.
That has happened before. I mean, the reason why punk came along was because of the elaborate kind of infrastructure surrounding some of the bigger bands that started to play the stadiums in America, and people like Pink Floyd and Yes. And also, with that elaborate presentation, became more flamboyant musicianship, which I think became the technique got in the way of the energy coming out, and it just got diluted. And then, of course, punk came along and said, "All you need is three notes or three chords, and couple of amplifiers and you're
Fuck
away.
The establishment, yeah.
You know, and then that happened, and then of course it became gluttonous and built up and got lazy. I think what happens is it just, you know, it becomes gluttonous and then strips down, becomes gluttonous and strips back down again to bone. But this time it's so stitched in with the experience of consumerism that that's not been allowed to go back to the bone again. It's just been held as this kind of wallpaper for shopping malls.
Oh, absolutely. I remember watching an episode of, and please forgive me for this, but an episode of Australian Idol one day. And one of the characters was this guy. He had his rings all through his face and had this total punk outlook, you know, this outward look of punk. And the interviewer said, "Oh, so you know, do you think about politics?" He goes, "No, I don't care for politics. Don't really even think about it. I don't know anything about it." And so it was this, it was back to this extreme capitalization of a popular form of music,
almost like a formula, but. I think some of the most political bands come from America. People like Henry Rollins and Jello Biafra from the Dead Kennedys.
The Dead Kennedys. What a great guy he is. Yeah, and you're
and,
right.
And
yeah.
Public Enemy as well. So I think, it's interesting that America's seen as this big problem. And, of course, well, it's not surprising, is it, that a lot of the political bands – and the MC5 were American as well, and all of that stuff, yeah.
Look, Simon, you've really got an incredibly encyclopedic knowledge, and I'd like to actually have you on again on the show again. I mean, tonight we've got Glenn Clancy coming up, and we probably need to wrap it up. I was just wondering if you would like to select a song for the break for the show. Is there anything that you can think of off your top of your head that you could request, and we could certainly play it to illustrate your arguments?
I think one song that would be great, bit of an oldie if you got it, "Won't Get Fooled Again" by The Who.
Well, I'm sure we can find that on YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks for coming in, Simon, and we'll definitely, if you can, make it back. We'll hear from you again.
Thanks, guys. See you around.
Cheers.
The banners they all fold in the last war. looks any different to me. And the slogans are replaced by the by. And the parting on the left is now parting on the right. And the bills are gone no longer overnight. I'll tell you.
Well, tonight we have a very special guest, Glenn Clancy, speaking to us from Japan. Glenn Clancy has made quite a name for himself in the 9/11 truth movement with an extraordinary film that he made single-handedly in 2007. Glenn is a graduate of Monash University, Commerce and Arts, and he's got a lot of skills and a lot of ability to put together a story, and he's done that in an extremely original way for an extremely important topic, which is the Bali bombings in Indonesia, which occurred in 2002, and also a very good breakdown of some of the political undercurrents of political interference that occurred during the East Timorese independence election and campaign for independence. So it's great to have you here on the show, Glenn. Welcome to Truth News Radio.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for that introduction.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I mean, you really have made quite a reputation for yourself. I've noticed your names come up quite a few times around the place. I just would love to know about how you came to make the film, what you know, anything interesting you can tell us about the process of making the film and what you've learned.
Well, I'd have to say it all started when I was watching some films through the internet in Japan, and I came across a little film called Loose Change, and this really, well, changed my life, because I started researching it. I couldn't believe that it was true, and I began researching it until I finally proved to myself that they were correct, and I wanted to learn more, and I'd always been interested in politics, but since the Iraq war began, I gave up, and I thought there's nothing I can do. Obviously, the majority of Australians didn't want to go to war, and yet we have a government that takes us into war. So what power have the people got? So I had given up until I saw this movie, and it really opened my eyes. And I knew that just a couple of guys were able to make this movie. So I set about researching primarily about Australian foreign policy, and obviously the Bali bombings came up as a major event. And
I think that the like you mentioned of how that the Iraq war sort of crushed everyone's like ability to think almost. And like I just really can relate to that. You know, I'm just like I think I went through that, and a lot of people I know went through a similar process. Yeah, and you know, the Bali bombing occurred really, well, it was before the Iraq war.
Right. Yeah.
And it was within a year of 9/11, and very little was said about it other than what we heard through the television, through the radio. There was just this. This onslaught of news about Iraq and Al Qaeda and Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden, yeah, it was just an absolute media, you know, blitzkrieg of propaganda at that time, I think, yeah.
Well, that was one of the things with the Bali bombings. There was, you know, they named off 10 different masterminds within 3 months.
Yeah.
So from the onset, people were confused. They didn't know what was going on. And a lot of people just gave up and didn't, you know, I can't understand what's happening, so why bother listening anymore, became the attitude. And I think that was part of their plan, in a way. The cover-up that was underway, they kept giving us all this misinformation, which really confused the people.
The misinformation, disinformation, spin, propaganda, I mean, you know, a lot of different words to basically mean lying. And, you know, they lied.
Yes.
And it's one of these things that we have to deal with, you know, as we start to realize what's going on, is the degree of just blatant lying. And you mean your investigation began with an interest in the Bali bombings, but in the film you actually go right back to 1999, and you take a really good long look at the whole East Timorese business, which I thought was really valid too and really important.
Well, I researched Australia's foreign policy, so I researched East Timor as well, and I'd also done a lot of research on the lead up to the Iraq War, and I actually was going to put that in as well. But having contacted Robert Finnegan and him confirming a lot of the information about the Bali bombings, I had to remove the content of the Iraq War because there was just too much. But in terms of East Timor, I couldn't leave that out because the lies were just so blatant from John Howard and Alexander Downer. I couldn't leave it out. It was just disgusting, and I really wanted to get that information out to people, and a lot of it came out already, but it has never been put all together, and a lot of the lies only came out 3 years after the event, so everyone forgets about it, and it was a very confusing. See, the main issue with the East Timor massacres was what the Australian government knew and when they knew it. So during the time, they just denied it the whole time.
Yeah.
And people were like, well, how do we know if they're lying or not? We don't. And then it came out a couple of years later, yes, they lied about this, they lied about this, they lied about this. But, you know, it was 3 years later, people moved on and didn't really understand the full extent of their lies and what the lies meant to the East Timorese people.
It seems that the lies were really destructive, and almost that, and they deliberate. Wanted that they actually wanted a bloodbath in East Timor, which is really horrific. I mean, you can write it down to sort of political shenanigans, but the effect was the murder of a lot of people, and
I think the main reason was. There is a really strong, in fact, after I completed the movie, I did a little bit more research, and it seems to me that there is a very strong Indonesian lobby within the Australian government, which stemmed from the Suharto regime, and it hasn't gone away. It's still there. So when the Indonesian government wanted to keep occupation of East Timor, the Australian government felt that they had to let them do that. And in order to do that, they had to lie. So, and that's why they did lie, I believe.
In order to sort of maintain that relationship that they had with the corrupt government of the time.
Yes, because if they hadn't have lied, they would have been exposing the Indonesian government to their criminal activities.
Right, right. Are you saying the criminal activities of the Indonesian government or the criminal activities of the Australians?
The Indonesian.
Right, I see, yeah.
But primarily the military, obviously.
And the military who are arming the militias and...
Exactly.
And it seemed that there was a game there of actually, on both sides, the Australians wanted there to be some reason why they had to bring the troops in. That's kind of the impression I wanted. So if it had been all peaceful and everyone was getting along okay, well, there wouldn't really have been a need for an Australian intervention, would there? It wouldn't have been necessary for that to have occurred. And I don't know. They're still very much in control of East Timor, what I noticed. Years later, it's still, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that because the American government actually tried to send peacekeepers and argued against the Australian government that they wanted to send in Marines and peacekeepers, but the Australian government argued against it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they were on side with the Indonesian government, yes.
So the Americans were going to send peacekeepers?
Yes, they wanted to. Right. Because, you know, they wanted to spread their influence around the world. They saw this as a good opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Australian government was so bound to the Indonesian government that they didn't want to expose them.
Interesting thing I wanted to point out, and maybe, you know, we'll discuss this more as we get into discussing the Bali bombings, but in your account of the Bali bombings, there is a discussion of the fact that there were, I think, 5 peacekeepers who were stationed in East Timor who were evacuated to out of the hospital. They were dead. I mean, they were bodies, okay. But they were evacuated without any due process.
Yep.
Is there a connection here? Is there something
that's there's definitely a connection because, you know, how else would have these people known that these UN peacekeepers were there and flown them out so quickly?
Right.
And this is within hours of the blast. Witnesses saw in the hospital, and because it was pandemonium, there was dead bodies everywhere, people burning and dying, and it was pandemonium. And these people, I don't know if they're in uniform or not, but they came, I can't remember, but they came into the hospital and took these 5 bodies, and they got onto a flight and were taken. And it kind of
suggests that those individuals were not just your plain ordinary peacekeepers, but I mean, it's just speculation, but I mean, it sort of certainly indicates there's something more going on that we obviously don't know about.
Yes, yes. But I mean, more than that, and that's the only information we know, and then it becomes speculation, you're right.
Yeah.
But more importantly, the thing that isn't speculation is that one of Robert Finnegan's, who was one of the senior editors at the Jakarta Post, one of his investigation team went to the international airport in Bali to check the flight records, and there had been a lot of flights the day before the bombing and the day of the bombing and the day after the bombing that were changed and being whited out and then changed. They were both deleted and changed.
Right.
And then this man proceeded to go down to the ground logs, and the flights were all there. And the ones that they had deleted in the tower logs were still in the ground logs that they hadn't deleted. And this flight was actually registered as an Israeli Israeli aeroplane, which went to Singapore after, and this was carrying the 5 bodies, and that went to Singapore, and then they lost track of it after that.
Okay.
But I didn't put that in the movie.
Yeah,
didn't put that in the movie. Because it gets sticky because there's not enough information about it. I mean, all we know is that some flights were deleted. And that's the question. Why were these flights deleted? And the days before that were completely clean. And it was only the days around the bombing that had been changed and deleted.
Oh, g'day, Glenn. It's Josh here.
How are you, mate?
Good, good. One part of the film that really blew my mind was was the episode of Mythbusters that you put in there. It was just a little cut when they blew apart a massive cement mixer. And I remember seeing that episode. It was absolutely amazing because they basically just blew this thing to smithereens. They had massive bomb experts. They had to move kilometers away from this scene. And the thing didn't even leave a crater. I mean, this thing it exploded so harshly that there was only tiny bits of debris of this full-on cement mixer, which wasn't just a cement mixer, but the barrel of the cement mixer at the back was half filled with solidified concrete. And the myth was to try and can you use dynamite to, you know, get rid of this thing, as you know, Glenn.
Can we just before we get right into that, because like I really want to get into that if we've got time.
Sure.
But I was just getting Glenn to kind of lead us into this, because I mean we're talking here about some issues that he covered in the film which precede the Bali bombings.
Right.
We talked about the East Timorese liberation campaign of independence,
sure. Yep.
the elections and the violence that occurred there. And, you know, we were just talking about the connection with the peacekeepers who were evacuated from the hospital. But now, the whole question of the bombing, which occurred at that crucial time, which was in the lead up to the Iraq War, it was one of the most important single events that kind of propelled Australia to be part of the war, but it also had an international effect. I mean, it was such a huge bombing. It was really, I mean,
a lot of Britons were killed, and I remember it was always this is Australia's 9/11. On the mainstream media was parroted constantly. Australia's 9/11. We've had our 9/11 now.
Yeah, yeah.
We've had our 9/11 now. And this was the psychological attack on us again. Now, whether that was an inside job or not, it was used as a massive psychological attack on us to then propel an agenda which was already written. But yeah, as Glenn points out in his fantastic film, it absolutely points to some really dodgy activity that needs to be investigated.
I think that it had two reasons that they wanted to have a massive terrorist attack in Indonesia, and that was, yes, to get the Australians on side with the Iraq War, which didn't work, but the Australian government went anyway, and to get the perception out that there were terrorists in Southeast Asia, which to that stage was yet to be established. And after the Bali bombings, there was this whole Jamaat Islamiyah, and there was a Southeast Asia Al-Qaeda. And so there were two main reasons, I think, for this operation.
And when this film came out, sorry to divert a little bit, what sort of reaction did you send out to some of the family members, and did you get any reaction to them?
I haven't yet, because I wanted to give them a chance to receive it passively. I didn't want to put this information on them so they would feel pressured.
Mm.
So I'm hoping that they are able to see this just by chance.
Yeah, I can understand your caution there, and it's well advised. I mean, it's a very tricky one to approach.
Well, it's a deep rabbit hole, you know. People need to slowly, I guess, ease into the fact that the governments aren't the you know, beautiful mother that it's touting to be.
But if we can just get back into the flow of this of the. Basically, the stuff you cover in the film, because I'm really interested in how you actually. One question I wanted to ask you is how you got all of that footage, because it's really great footage in East Timor, and you've where did you find all that stuff?
I found that on YouTube.
Really, really, it was all available on YouTube, was it? Fantastic.
Yeah. That's, so.
and the power of the internet.
I mean, I've never sold it, so
right.
That's what I'm going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, how long did it take you to make from cradle to grave? When?
Well, I researched for about 7 months,
right,
solid, and then it probably took me about 3 months to make the movie.
Once you basically compiled everything, yeah. So you compiled all your resources.
Yeah, and then I wrote the script and I wrote exactly what I wanted to make.
Right.
And then it took me about 3 months to make it in the program.
What sort of video editing did you use, if you don't mind my asking?
I used, it's called Sony Vegas.
Sony Vegas, yeah, I use that. Yeah, it's quite good, isn't it?
So, and this was my first time.
Yeah.
Using this program, so
sure.
Hopefully, it came out okay.
it does. It. I mean, it has a good flow. You know, when the first time I watched it, I thought, oh, it was a bit odd that you had all that material on East Timor. But when I actually sat through and watched it, I was really glad that I did.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a pattern of deception, and this is what we've got to realize, and we've got to, you know, I don't know. None of us really know what the solution to this is. All we know is that we've got to talk about it. We've got to get it out there. We've got to get people to understand.
I think the main thing with Australians is they really, truly, they haven't lived through tyranny. Apart from the Aboriginal people who absolutely have, but the general white Aussie has really lived a gluttonous lifestyle of total, you know, everything at their fingertips. And that's not to say, I mean, this is even the hardworking Aussies. There's always food on the table. There's been a safety net of the dole. And you know, some people have had it hard. Don't you mean, I'm not painting the whole of Australia with an easy brush, but hardcore tyranny hasn't really arisen yet. So this whole notion that governments might do something bad to gain an agenda or gain further an agenda, it really doesn't even come into the psyche of the general middle class Aussie, and to sort of, I think films like this to sort of wake up and see and categorize and chronicle the deceptions that were paved through the East Timor and to the Bali bombings. I mean, just to go back to that point about the MythBusters exploding thing. I mean, what I found fascinating about that is it really outlaid. This was such a massive explosion, and it left no crater in the ground in the MythBusters thing. Now, the crater in the Bali bombing and the second bomb that went off was, it was quite massive.
Exactly. And do you know that was dynamite that they used in MythBusters? Because I never found out exactly what it was.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it was. It was based TNT, I'm pretty sure.
So it does prove that it's going to take a larger explosion than that which was seen in the MythBusters episode than the one they're saying, because they claim that it was about a ton of potassium chlorate. Now, TNT is about, or dynamite with TNT is about 5 times more powerful than potassium chlorate. Now, if this truck has been loaded with TNT, you know, and you've got a van loaded with potassium chlorate, well, it's no comparison. And so right there, you've got a massive hole in the story.
And a massive hole in the ground too.
And
I mean, that was what really stood out with this supposed car bomb, is the, you know, giant crater.
And not only that, I mean, windows were smashed in a massive circumference of the actual center point, blast point.
Well, I mean, I've seen aerial photographs, and it looks like ground zero of Hiroshima. I mean, it's just flattened. Everything's flattened.
The most important piece of evidence is now at the bottom of the ocean, where they, which they dumped into the ocean within about a week of the investigation starting, and that is the the rebar, which was stripped of its concrete. Now, yeah. that was 50 feet from the crater, which is obviously the point of the blast. And according to Marine Corps figures, it takes 1 million, at least 1 million pounds per square inch of overpressure to strip the concrete.
Now, were you able to see at all any examples of this rebar that had the concrete stripped from it?
I have. And I've recently seen better photos than I put into the movie. And
great.
In the movie, it is a little bit difficult to see because they were the only photos I had at the time. But I have since seen the actual concrete rod standing up, and then you can see the rebar coming out of that concrete, and it's been completely stripped. So it's clear as day that concrete has actually been stripped.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have you don't have to be an expert to understand that stripping concrete from rebar must take an incredible amount of energy. I mean, it's just it's really quite incredible.
Well, it's elementary.
The math's there, right?
Because it's science. It takes at least 1 million. Now, potassium chlorate at that distance has a maximum overpressure force of about 2 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
So, you know...
That's a smoking gun right there.
Yeah. It's case closed. It's impossible that it was potassium chlorate. And their final conclusion was that it was potassium chlorate.
Glenn, was there ever any radioactivity measurements taken at the blast point, or some sort of Geiger counter out there to sort of check?
I think there was, but no independent. But this is the interesting point. The most likely explosive device that was used was a micronuclear device because of the stripped concrete and because the injuries and the way people died. I mean, some of the people completely vanished. Their bones, you know, if you've got stripped concrete, you're going to have stripped human beings.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were vanished. So,
yeah. So, how popular are these? I mean, how prevalent are these type of explosive device, if it was indeed something like a mini nuke?
Well, I think this is probably one of the first times it's been used.
Yeah.
And when you said the Geiger device, that doesn't measure. I think that only measures something like beta or alpha rays.
Right.
And that only measures the uranium type nuclear devices.
Uh-huh.
But if you have a plutonium nuclear device, it's not going to pick up the nuclear remnants in
that
the air.
That sort of footprint, right.
So, exactly. So you need a specific device to measure the radiation. You know,
I mean, and look,
this kind of technology was around 20 years ago that they had micronuclear devices. So yeah. You can imagine what they have today.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the military complex, that's all they do. They just research explosive devices, you know, spend billions of dollars on this stuff. Mm. So it's not impossible.
Important point is that people think that, oh, micronuclear device, well, then where's all the radiation? Why aren't people dying later? Well, with the plutonium nuclear device, people in direct contact will die straight away, and other people will not suffer long-term diseases. It will only be the people in immediate contact who will have died that will be affected by the blast.
And there were examples of people who were vaporized. I've heard some, you know, extreme cases of bodies just completely being just
fried.
How
can you prove that they were vaporized?
Maybe not totally vaporized, but certainly charred beyond any, you know, possible recognition.
Well, that's another very important point, that the official death toll was 202. Yeah. Now, I just read an article a couple of weeks ago that a lot of people in the hospital at the time, they were saying 187 people had died, and they were all saying that count is ridiculous. It's more like 300. Mm. It's more like 400 people, because there were still about over 100 bags of human remains that weren't even accounted for.
Well, it's funny that they didn't take advantage of that and just over-report it.
Overdo it. Mm. Well, then it would have made it more difficult to cover up the fact that it was a potassium chlorate explosive.
Yeah. And Glenn, what are you going to do after now? Is there a chance of a second edition from some of this new information you've come out, or are you on other projects now? Or?
Well, I'm thinking about it. I'm toying with the idea. If I get enough information, I probably will.
Yeah.
But I'm still yet to decide.
Well, it's a very, very amazing documentary. It's a very important documentary because it's the only one that actually challenged anything.
Yeah.
From all the, you know, million-dollar mainstream media investigative journalists out there, you know, here's a kid that's produced something so important and so amazing, and I really congratulate you. You know, well,
thanks very much.
It was fantastic.
The story wouldn't even been, I mean, the main reason why I did it was because of Robert Finnegan, who was the senior editor at the Jakarta Post at the time. And he was, if you've seen the movie, he was fired from his job because
yeah.
he was exposed too much. Because actually in his special report that he printed a couple of months after the attacks, he outlined the concrete that was stripped. And he put in the actual Marine Corps figures in his article shortly after he was sacked and had his journalist visa cancelled. So, you know, his team, you're right, was the only team, were the only people that were brave enough to not simply blindly accept the official story.
Now, I think yeah, it's excellent. And, you know... I think the question of what type of bomb it was is not one we have to answer. And this is a common problem with these things where we're yeah. looking into unknowns. We know that it was a very powerful bomb. We know it must have been a high-tech bomb. The question of whether it was a nuke or whether it was just some other high-tech explosive, well, really, it doesn't matter because... And quite often these discussions get hung up on a single point like that, and then you get the media hit pieces that go, oh, such and such person has a conspiracy theory, you know, oh, they believe nukes were used, oh, how crazy is that? So, and this is a very, very common pattern that I've seen over and over again, and like what I'd just like to emphasize, you know, for our audience, is that we don't, when we're dealing with things that we really don't have all the facts, we cannot offer the answer, and it would be ridiculous to assume we could. But I mean, in your film, you quite make a plausible scenario that it may well be this, but
yeah.
the points that you make, I think that have the strongest that make the strongest convincing argument. Is when you just show that the physical process of the blast cannot have come from what they said it came from, which means they were lying. And this thing about catching people in lies is very important. Like we got to realize that when you're trying to get to the truth of something, you may never get the real truth. You may be able to catch people in lies. And you know, this brings me to the next. Topic that I want you to actually get into a little bit with us. We'll just after the break. I'm just going to pause it there for a minute because I want to. After this, I want to ask you about the intelligence community. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm Heriwood Fenton, and Josh Jackson is here tonight, and we are talking to Glenn Clancy, the creator, producer, director, and, you know, completely original
thinker
behind Fool Me Twice, an internet movie covering Indonesian events such as the East Timorese elections and independence campaign and the Bali bombings, and evidence of deception, Australian government complicity, Indonesian government complicity, and complicity from various parts of the international intelligence community. And it's that last part that I want to get into discussing with Glenn in this part of the interview. Glenn, in the film, you document that there were a number of relationships that took place between several of the Bali bombers and several intelligence operatives, and you point out a few things that I found really, really interesting. And one of them was that one of these people was actually, I think, arrested and then released and ended up in Afghanistan and then was locked up in the American prison there in Bagram Air Force Base and then somehow escaped again. I don't know if there's anything you can
Well, that was Omar al-Farouk.
Yeah.
And he was actually rendered over to the United States by the Indonesian government about in June of 2002, so that was 4 months before the bombings.
Okay.
And he, in fact, was cited in American intelligence reports and Australian intelligence reports that there was going to be an event in Indonesia, a terrorist attack. And obviously that that occurred. And then after the bombings, he was called into U.S. court, and immediately he was called into court, the Bush administration claimed that he had escaped the high security prison in Afghanistan that he was staying at.
As you do.
As you do.
Can't be that hard.
Oh, you're just a high security, you know.
Jump over the fence, eh?
Well, you know, it's pretty much impossible. So not only do you have a high-level supposed al-Qaeda operative escaping jail, but he was the prime source of information that was going to occur. And, in fact, that information was used to threaten the Indonesian government to hand over Abu Bakar Bashir before the bombing.
Oh, before the bombing?
Before the bombings. See, Abu Bakar Bashir was the CIA threatened President Megawati to hand over Bashir before the bombings, but President Megawati refused because he was too well known. This was speculated about in the media, but the American government denied that they had tried to secretly hand him over. But the American translator that was in that meeting decided to speak out and actually told everyone that, yeah, that actually did take place, that they had tried to secretly hand him over. And interestingly enough, this man becomes the main person of the bombings, and he's the mastermind, and he's the one that they try to blame.
So you suspect that he may well be an intelligence operative.
Abu Bakar Bashir?
I know the other chap that was
Omar.
Yeah. And now, are there others that you can identify as being intelligence operatives who were connected to the Bali bombers? Because I think there are a few other things in the film.
Well, the former, just before I get on to other people, the former Indonesian intelligence chief, A.C. Manilang, said 2 months before the bombings that Omar al-Farouk was, in fact, a CIA agent. And he had been sent to recruit people for a terrorist network.
Well, that's pretty damning, isn't it?
There's been high-level people that have said that Omar al-Farouk was a CIA agent, and then he goes ahead and escapes jail.
See, with such amazing information, why hasn't some of these journalists actually exposed this?
Yeah. Why does hasn't it take... it been on the ABC?
Yeah, why have you seen it?
Been on SBS? It just proves right there.
It really infuriates me.
Other people, well, there was another person who had been in contact with Omar al-Farouk, but I don't think was directly involved in the Bali bombings. His name was Fatah Roman al-Ghozi, and he was captured in the Philippines, I think, and then he escaped jail too. So I think it's safe to say whenever a high-level al-Qaeda operative escapes jail, you can be sure that there's more to the story.
So did he escape jail at the same time? Was it the same?
It was a different time. Different time, different place.
Oh, God. It's just unbelievable, isn't it? It just goes on and on. It truly is. I mean, when the Australian government said this is the next 9/11, they were right. I mean, there's just so much damning evidence that people really... To not expose this further is a crime in itself.
And the other possibly most important person was Fawzi Hasbi, who actually facilitated a so-called Jama'a Islamiyah meeting in January of 2000, and he was later exposed as an Indonesian intelligence agent by SBS Australia. SBS Australia's Dateline, and shortly after he was exposed, he was murdered.
You are joking.
And his son, who gave the interview to SBS Dateline, died in a plane crash soon after as well.
I remember that, yeah.
There's a lot more to this man, Fawzi Hasbi, because he was facilitating meetings around 2000, and this is the same time that Abu Bakr Bashir decided to go public with his Islamic movement, and he created the Mujahideen Council of Indonesia. And the International Crisis Group actually reported that Abu Bakr Bashir had a falling out with a lot of the members in his group. And this is when the bombing campaigns began. And in the year of 2000, there was the Christmas Eve bombings, which a lot of mysterious things about that event as well. And Fawzi Hasbi was actually the center of that plot of the Christmas bombings.
You're kidding.
And he had actually called the man that was sent to jail for building the bombs. He had actually called that man several times in the lead up to the bombings. So he was a central part of the 2000 Christmas Eve bombings, and he was later exposed as an Indonesian.
The Christmas Eve bombings, which took place where exactly?
All across Indonesia. It was a
all across bombing. Indonesia.
There were a few cities that were bombed, churches.
You know, it's interesting. Here in Australia, they just recently been going over these some sort of Islamic terrorist, so-called terrorist group here in Australia, and they got arrested. And it turns out that, you know, they're just casually reporting on the news that, well, there was an insider from the police, from ASIO, had got in there. And then as the story goes on, you realize that this ASIO guy was teaching them how to make the bombs, that these guys didn't actually know how to make any of the bombs. It was this, Australian government agent basically setting them up, taking them into the woods and showing them, and then this crazy guy who was obviously nuts saying, "Oh, could you make a bigger one for us?" And then they basically sting him and arrest him.
Mm. Well, Abu Bakr Bashir was actually being set up before in the 70s. He was actually set up by the Suharto military intelligence, and he was sent to jail for almost 3 years for creating a so-called Jama'a, which is a community, to fight against the communists. But he was actually provoked into that by military intelligence. So he's actually been set up before 30 years ago.
God, it sounds very much like the Al-Qaeda of... Afghanistan.
It sounds very much like the CIA. I mean, I just want to tie this in to the practices that the CIA have been using all over the world. And I know the CIA were very closely involved with the Suharto government. They basically allowed Suharto to come to power. They wanted to get Sukarno out of the way. Sukarno was the nationalist leader who was the kind of really the popular leader of the people after the Dutch were kicked out of Indonesia. And he was not a perfect person. Obviously, he had his faults, but he wasn't such a tyrant as Suharto, and he had a lot of relationships with the Russians as well as the Americans. He was playing both sides, and they didn't want him there. And basically, there was a massive coup d'état that occurred in Indonesia in the mid 1960s under the careful guidance of the CIA. And I mean, this whole decade of the 60s was a period where interventions in other countries, as well as within the United States, with the assassination of Kennedy, which again was another government run operation. And had all the hallmarks of the same types of things that you're talking about, Glenn. It's just interesting because I was recently watched Oliver Stone's JFK, and just like the things that we're talking about here, where you have like government operatives getting involved with terrorist groups, sort of training them, preparing patsies. All this occurred in relation to the Kennedy assassination. And it's quite clear that Oswald was an operative who was working under military intelligence. He was actually, you know, playing both sides, as they often do. Once for a while he was communist, then he was anti-communist. There were all these total anomalies, and the whole while the planning of this event, which was the assassination of Kennedy, was being prepared. He was set up to be the patsy, as he himself said, and this was all being run from within a cell of the FBI. I mean, the whole operation. And so, what's staggering?
Well, it's the modus operandi of almost all intelligence agencies in the world that have any influence.
Yeah,
it was exactly the same with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which is in the movie.
Yes.
They were all on the payroll of the CIA. So, and the bomb was actually built by the FBI. So,
yeah,
it's always intelligence agencies involved.
And grooming of people that they can use in variety of roles. I mean, it's just incredible. And the reach of these organizations that they're able to do this is chilling. The fact that they're able to manipulate people to find their weaknesses, to exploit their anger and their hatred about various things, to set up patsies, and you know, one thing that's occurred to me about this, and you know, I've done a fair amount of research on a lot of different levels, is that when you have a very deliberate attempt to subvert justice by creating false flag operations, it is virtually impossible for a normal justice system to operate. Because by that I mean when a well-organized group can basically set up a fake event And then have an individual who is set up to be the fall guy for the event, by creating false chain of evidence.
That's great.
The average person cannot deal with it. It is too mind boggling for the average person to grasp that this has actually been done deliberately, and they win every time with this. It's a technique that they've used over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, it's like giving some kid who's or some family is absolutely dead poor, can't afford to feed themselves, some dope, and giving them out in the street, and then arresting them for it. You know, you're basically setting these people up, people that they're doing something. So,
but my point, Josh, was with the general public, though. And because like what I'm pointing out is that the general public is incapable of grasping when they've been hoodwinked.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, example is Port Arthur. Now, I've done a fair amount of research into Port Arthur. And what I know is that the supposed reports of Martin Bryant having been seen early in the day having an argument at a toll booth. Now, this is a pattern I've seen over and over again. Muhammad Atta was reported having an argument in an airport toll booth. Martin Bryant had a loud argument which grabbed everyone's attention, right? This is a deliberate tactic. The person who did that was not Martin Bryant, okay? The person who did that, in my assessment, was the person that they assigned to do that to make a witness, to create a witness event, so that you would say that, so someone would say, oh, I saw a guy, he had an argument with me, he had long blonde hair. That's the Martin Bryant. With Muhammad Atta, it was, again, he had several arguments which drew attention to himself, and then later on that became part of the narrative. And the same thing happens in the Kennedy assassination with Lee Harvey Oswald. You have Lee Harvey Oswald going around shooting ranges, and it wasn't really Lee Harvey Oswald, because Lee Harvey Oswald was actually in Mexico at the time, but it was a guy who matched the description of Lee Harvey Oswald, same build, same height, same hair, who went to a shooting range and said in a loud voice, oh, I'm practicing to shoot the president. I mean, you know, this is, it's ridiculous, but it works because it sets up in people's mind an expectation of, well, this can't be coincidence. You know, there can't be so many coincidences. This must be evidence. And that's all they need. In many cases, it never goes to court. With all of these false flag operations like Muhammad Atta, well, he never had to go to court. You know, he was removed from the equation. Martin Bryant, well, he was, you know, mentally, you know, basically mentally retarded anyway. So he wouldn't have been able to defend himself. But they set up these events. They use false evidence. And it's all about a public relations game of convincing the general public their little game, you know.
To stay in fear. Yeah. Yeah. So I think what would you, Glenn, say to the general public to you know, what was your purpose for making this film? I guess to wake people up to the indiscretions and the things that weren't reported on?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Bali bombings, no one knows what actually happened. I mean, you ask the average person on the street in Australia, they'll say, yeah, Amrozi did it.
Mm.
And that's it. That's all they'll know. So...
yeah, with Amrozi, that's one thing. Why doesn't he say, hey, look, you know, has his family been given some money, or I mean, how can someone
high possibility, because he is a primary school graduate and he's obviously illiterate and he's a mechanic. So, you know, he's not a very intelligent person, and it's highly possible that he has been given bribes.
Yeah.
And given all the other evidence that the investigators have blatantly lied, that is a very probable answer.
Yeah, because that's one thing I haven't ever, you know, because he must have been sitting there in court, and they must have, you know, skipped over a lot of this information in court, even lightly, about the size of the bomb and stuff. I mean, yeah, so obviously there's something going on there, yeah.
Well, he might have been tortured. Well, he claims that he was tortured, all three of them.
Yeah.
And they were tortured to saying that Bashir was their leader and that Bashir was part of a group called Jamaat Islamiyah. And so they reported that they were tortured. So in the beginning, during the court cases, that was probably the reason why they gave the so-called correct answers. But in terms of today, why they don't speak, it could be bribes, could be, we don't really know. But they have said at different times that Amrozi did say that the bomb that he prepared could not have caused that damage, and it must have been the CIA. So they have on occasions said that it was intelligence agencies.
Yeah, that's right.
The blast.
Huh. This chap, the head of the police, what's his name, who went and saw Bush and Cheney and was gloating about it, the head of the intelligence we were talking about earlier.
Which man?
I think it was either the head of the Indonesian anti-terror police or...
General Dave Akhtiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just wanted to explain to the audience this culture where the anti-terror squads really need terrorism to survive, because the amount of funding they got after that bomb was phenomenal.
Well, there's a section in the film, Glenn, where this police chief is taken, well, he's describing how well he was treated and he had a wonderful time and they took him to this marvelous place. Do you remember the bit we're talking about?
Yeah,
I know exactly the bit you're talking about. Yes. And he was gloating about how he had met Dick Cheney and had been to the White House and they were following him around like a puppy dog.
Yeah.
Mm.
You've really chosen some amazing footage there, and because that scene just stood out. Because I actually remember seeing that on mainstream media when it happened. I remember thinking, what a dodgy guy, you know. And this is the culture of terrorism. I mean, if you look at all the courses in anti-terrorism now, universities and intelligence courses, it's this whole culture we're building around an industry of fear, an industry of terrorism that basically entrenches the need for terrorism in the future, because all these people need a job. And that's really an important part of the film that you put in there, is that that it's really showing these people for what they are, happy, almost happy. He had his chest puffed out. I met Dick Cheney. I mean, it was really absolutely disgusting to see.
Well, it's a self-perpetuating myth. I mean, there is no Al-Qaeda network, and it's a myth. And these people, they're chasing ghosts.
Mm. But it suits their ego, and obviously probably financially too,
Absolutely,
with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Look, there's one more thing I wanted to get into tonight a little bit, and I don't know if you're able to really elaborate on this more, but a famous quote from the former Indonesian president, Abdul Rahman Wahid, Gus Dur, he's sometimes known as, the blind one, who was president briefly for, I think, about a year or two. Now, he was interviewed on SBS Dateline, I think, in about 2003, and he said blatantly, he just said it straight out, he said, yes, well, the Bali bombers, Amrozi and those people, they were responsible for the little bomb, but the Indonesian government, the Indonesian military was responsible for the large bomb. And I've never heard any follow-up on that. I've never heard anything more on it.
Well, they claim that he's the conscience of the nation.
Yep.
So he has high respect, probably more respect than any other president that's ever been in Indonesia. And, yeah, he said that the so-called Bali bombings were set up and that the main explosive was possibly put there by the military. He said he didn't know who. He said possibly by the military. So... you have the most respected person in Indonesia saying that these guys were set up.
Amazing.
And zero, you know, I mean, the Australian Federal Police, with all their amazing forensic abilities, leading the investigation, managed to uncover just
Smiling assassin.
you know, the confessions of the bombers. Basically, I mean, why would they even need police work? I mean, they always either managed to get identification, like they got from the London bombers, where they got all their identification miraculously preserved, even though their bodies were blown to bits, their identification was in perfect nick.
Hardcore laminating, mate.
Yeah, or they just get confessions. I mean, it's so easy doing police work these days, isn't it? I mean,
well, I read that they actually had 3D simulators of the buildings and the position that the explosive went off.
Wow!
And then they ran all the witnesses through that 3D image, describing what happened.
Wow!
And they can't even get the explosive right.
Yeah.
So they did a 3D model of the explosion. My goodness.
Yeah.
That must have cost a bit of public money.
Interestingly, I read recently that they had people at the international airport searching people's bags and taking footage off people as they boarded the plane to leave back to Australia.
Another standard CIA intel black op, you know, procedure, you know, just, and the other thing I heard from, I listened to that interview with Robert Finnegan, and he was saying that within 24 hours of the attacks, Bali, Kuta Beach was swarming with international intelligence agents. Again, another signature of a black op. I mean, do you know anything more about that? I can't remember whether that's covered in your film or not, but
it's not, no, yeah. But yeah, he said there were CIA, Mossad, and even French intelligence and other intelligence agencies, which he could not identify, but he suspected that they were there by the time he got there. And he was there within hours. I guess that he was probably there within 12 hours, and all these intelligence operatives were already at the scene.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff, Glenn. Well, I think we should wrap it up.
Okay.
Glenn, thank you very, very much for coming on. We'll have to have you on again sometime.
Not a problem.
An amazing film. Where can people see this?
If you type Fool Me Twice into Google Video, it should come up number one.
Fool Me Twice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Glenn, I'd like to have you on again soon and you know, regularly to keep up to date with what your next plans are. I know you're planning to return to Australia and you know, just best of luck with whatever your next project is. But we'd like to stay informed, and we'd like to just keep everyone else informed as well.
No problems at all. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Glenn. Cheers, mate.
Okay,
there
well,
goes
that's
Glenn
a wrap.
Clancy, amazing guy, amazing filmmaker.
And that is the end of the show, and I seem to have lost my partner, Josh. Josh, farewell. Good night, Australia. Good night, world. See you next week.